It's now time for the Fantasy 411 Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411 Podcast. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with Fred Zinke, a fantasy expert with more titles, honors, everything than I could begin to list. So just say he knows a lot and he's good at this stuff. Fred, how you doing today?
I'm feeling good. How are you?
I am just dandy. Well, it's real nice here in Georgia today. The winter is when I like it here the most. We don't have a whole lot of transactions. There's still some guys out there, but not a lot of moves, but a couple things to talk about. And we start with Yoenis Cespedes, who I actually think is really interesting. You know, there's a certain degree of, well, he stayed in the same place. But I find Cespedes a really interesting guy who I think has a whole lot of variables, both in on the field but also in fantasy. First of all, I just sort of broadly, give me an overview of what you see for Cespedes in a full year at Citi Field in the Mets lineup.
Yeah, I think that owners who are hoping for 35 homers like he hit last season are going to be disappointed. I'm more setting my expectations for 25 home runs and maybe about 90 RBIs, you know, maybe about 80 runs scored. That's where I think he falls in. I think that he's in that kind of second tier of outfielders with Justin Upton's, Adam Jones, Carlos Gomez, players like that. I don't think that he's going to perform as well as he did last year, and I'm afraid some people are going to draft him that way.
One of the things that stands out, and we start getting to really small numbers here, so it's entirely possible it's just noise. But Cespedes is a guy who ran a decent amount his first year in the major leagues and then very little since then. 16 steals his first year, and then not more than 7 in any other year. But in 57 games with the Mets last year, he stole 4 bases. Project that out over a season, you're talking 10 or 11. You're not drafting him for the speed, but that becomes something that maybe you at least pay attention to. Do you think there's something there, or do you think that's just, if you're going to steal 7 over the course of the year, there's a decent chance a few of them will be bunched in a 2-month span?
Yeah, I think I'm going with the latter, and in fact, there was a 5-game span with the Mets where he stole 3 bases. So that there kind of accounts for the entire abnormality. And you could say, you know, you could look at it from the outside. You're right. We're talking about really small numbers and say, oh, National League, maybe a little more running game. You know, I don't know. Maybe he's heading towards free agency and he wants to kind of show off his wheels a little bit and that kind of thing. But I would take the under on 10 steals.
Again, a guy I could talk about a lot because I just find him so interesting. You know, he's 30, so that's potentially the start of a decline phase for some guys, but he's coming off his best year. He's been wildly inconsistent from year to year. I mean, he's had in 12, he hit 292. In 13, he hit 240. We've seen as many as 35 and as few as 22 home runs. How do you, I mean, you just gave me your sort of broad projection for him, but a guy with that sort of wide variation, how do you kind of manage that, just philosophically, I mean, even less about Cespedes specifically, but just sort of strategically, how do you address guys like that whose performance can be really all over the place?
Yeah, I'm going to probably try to look for the outlier, and to me, that's why I started off a little pessimistic, and last season to me kind of was the outlier. If you look at 2012, 23 homers, 2013, 26, 2014, 22. So in the power department, he's pretty consistent prior to last season. I don't see a really good reason why the home run rate jumped so much. In fact, he hit fewer fly balls and more ground balls last season, and he had a higher percentage of fly balls that left the yard. So I feel like that's usually not really a repeatable skill, especially at his developmental stage. So that's why I'm more inclined to put him in that 25-ish home run range. He's always been someone who can drive in runs, and he's been reasonably durable. So I think he's solid. You're right. The batting average has been more all over the place. If I was going to be a little more concerned, it would be that the two previous years to 2015, he hit 2013. Sorry, he hit 240. 2014, he hits 260. So that makes me kind of skeptical that he's really a 290 hitter, even though I know he was in his rookie season. So maybe you split the difference a bit, but the power numbers I'm inclined to almost throw last season out.
Let's take it a little step farther with the Mets here. This probably means that Juan Lagares is not going to play much. I mean, that, weren't counting on Lagares for a lot anyway. But 2 years ago, he hit .281 and stole 13 bases. You see any value for Lagares, or do you just wait till he's traded somewhere?
Yeah, I think he just NL only people could take him in the final round. For him, assuming he isn't traded, he will need an injury to get to play on a regular basis, and that could happen to one of the three starters at some point during the season. I could see him cutting into playing time a little bit for Michael Conforto. I don't know if that'll happen for sure, but they basically didn't let Conforto face lefties in his rookie year. Now, thinking developmentally, it'd be really good for him to face lefties throughout this season so that he can become a better all-around hitter. But now that their outfield's so deep and Lagares is best against lefties, I wonder if he'll cut into Conforto's playing time a little bit, where when they're facing a lefty, they can say, oh, we'll move Cespedes over to left, put Lagares in center, get a better defensive lineup out there, and then Lagares is pretty good against lefties. So I wonder if like, obviously Lagares is right off the radar, but I wonder if there could be a small negative effect from the signing on Conforto that people aren't really talking about.
And then the other guy in that mix who I think is interesting is Alejandro Deaza, a guy who, you know, you're not going to go crazy on draft day, but a guy who I think a few people have probably picked up during seasons and been pretty happy with. It's hard to see where he gets any run at all. I mean, he went from a guy who maybe gets regular playing time to a guy who I almost don't see a spot for him. Do you kind of see him that way right now?
Yeah, for sure. And I've always kind of liked Deaza in fantasy because he's got the speed for like a bit of a baseline for him and then a little bit of power. Like, you can sometimes get a 20 steal season out of him and get a few home runs on top of that. And for sure he's a low end guy, but he's playing fairly regularly. Like, he's pretty useful. And I'm wondering if he kind of wishes that he could take back the contract he signed, because, you know, he kind of took that with the thought of being a part-time guy, maybe like a high volume fourth outfielder or a platoon player, who probably would have gotten, you know, 350, 400 at-bats, and now you've got to think, if nothing gives here, that he's looking at, you know, a 200 at-bat season, and he's a better player than that.
And the funny thing is, the Mets are probably wishing the same thing, too, honestly. Not that Deaza isn't a valuable player, but they almost certainly brought him in thinking that he would be, not a Cespedes replacement, but take a lot of those at-bats. Probably like to have that money to spend somewhere else now that they've got Cespedes in the fold, but that's neither here nor there. I'm going to spring a little bit of a surprise on you here, because just landed in my email, Doug Fister to the Astros. Fister's another really interesting guy, and he's a guy who lived right on the margins so much but was so good. When a guy like that, who doesn't overpower people, has a big fall-off like he did last year, does that worry you more than a power guy? In other words, does Fister's bad year worry you more than, say, Jeff Samardzija's bad year?
Yeah, it does. And you hit the nail on the head with, you said, you know, he was living on the edge and producing really well despite that really low strikeout rate. For me, I'm going to think, when I think fantasy terms, I'm going to think, if I'm going to take a chance on someone who's coming off a really disappointing season, I want to know what's the upside if this whole thing straightens out. Because Fister's upside is still a low strikeout rate, I'm less inclined to take a chance on him. You know, we talked about Ian Kennedy last week and whether he could go to another level, and he was the kind of guy I talked about who tantalizes you because of the strikeout rate and therefore the upside. With Fister, I feel like, and you're right, this is just landing on my lap too, so I haven't had a long time to digest it, but what's the upside here? I guess the upside is solid ratios, and that's about it. And now he's going back to the American League, he's not going to get any break with the pitcher spot, and I'm just not really encouraged. I just don't see, if you're in a mixed league, why you take the late round pick on him when you can just take someone with probably more potential, probably coming off a better year. Do you think this could be a good fit for him?
It's weird to me. I mean, that's a guy that I would. Miami seemed like such a perfect fit in so many ways, and that was a match that got talked about a lot. You get a friendly ballpark, you get a place where you'd almost certainly. Not really. I mean, not that he has a problem with pressure, but that you'd seem very safe in him getting 30 starts if he was healthy. That really seemed like a fit. I mean, you go to Houston, presumably you think you've got a better chance to win, and that's not nothing. I understand that. But as far as kind of rebuilding your value, that doesn't seem like the place that he in particular is going to do that. But, you know, maybe they offered him more of an opportunity than somewhere else. But, yeah, I agree, a very strange fit. I understand why they take the flyer on him. If he is good, you've got a nice mid-to-back rotation starter. But it seems weird for him unless there just weren't other opportunities out there.
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, you're right. You talk about the prospect of winning, although if he went to Miami on a one-year deal, if they fall out of the race and he's pitching well, then he's probably on a contender by the end of July anyways. And, and if they're in the race, then he's on a contender there. So, I mean, he could have, without knowing the details of his contract with the Astros. Yeah, you're right. I'm surprised that more players in Fister's situation don't just look for the circumstances that will give them the best chance to resurrect their value rather than considering, the short-term impact of winning.
Then we bounce to a guy in something of a similar situation. Bronson Arroyo coming off a missed year rather than a bad year, but also trying to rebuild his value, also kind of an odd fit. What did you think when you saw Bronson Arroyo to Washington?
I guess this is a pretty good fit, and we talk just coming off the Fister conversation, right? Like the Nats should be a competitive team. There are multiple, teams in that division that aren't very strong offensively. So this is a pretty good situation for him. He probably needs to beat out Tanner Roark to get the last rotation spot. And the Nats showed last year that they're fine with just leaving Roark in the bullpen, to kind of use as a swingman if that's what they can do. So even though this kind of shapes up as a spring training battle between maybe the two pitchers, to me the battle is just Arroyo against himself, similar to when we talked last week about Fernando Rodney in San Diego. If Arroyo looks good, he gets that rotation spot. If he doesn't, then they don't have any ties to him and they just go with Roark. I wouldn't take him in a mixed league, same as Fister, because the strikeout rate's so low. But in an NL-only league, I wouldn't mind taking him late because, as I said, if he's pitching well, then he gets the spot, and if he isn't, then he doesn't. So if he's still on the team March 20th or March 25th, and it looks like he's going to get a rotation spot, then I'm interested.
And then, you mentioned the other part of that equation is Roark, who is a guy who's been, before last year, rather good as a reliever, decent as a starter. Do you see any value in him maybe as a sneaky reliever play? I mean, he's a guy I think they've kind of waited for a long time to turn into a back of the bullpen guy, and that hasn't happened. He's kind of a perplexing guy. Do you think it's fair to say?
Yeah, for sure. In an NL-only league, I wouldn't mind picking him up for a dollar or a late-round pick if he doesn't get that rotation spot and then no one wants him, because he was quite effective two seasons ago, and then expectations for him were pretty high briefly, and then he quickly fell off. I haven't totally given up on him. I do sometimes feel like he's a little maybe disrespected, maybe isn't the best word, but it's the best way I can come up with on the spot, by the Nats, and I'm surprised they can continually kind of try to get him. I feel like they try to get him out of the rotation, and, I don't know. I guess this is maybe, though, more of a move. Maybe it's not as much a move about Roark as it is about them just building up overall starting pitcher depth, because we talked previously about how they didn't have a lot in front of Lucas Giolito in the minors. So maybe this is just them more thinking, we need a sixth starter who's a veteran like Roark.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I see. I still see they found themselves, I think, a lot of last year wishing they had some alternatives and wishing they had some guys they could plug in rather than having to rely on some guys they didn't really want to rely on. So my first thought on Fister was that he would be he's kind of a plan B. But as you note, there's not a lot that's really set in stone, and we didn't really discuss this ahead of time. I apologize for, again, taking you off a twisty road here. We talked a little about Joe Ross last week, I think. What do you think, just as we talk about this Nationals rotation and how these pieces fit together, what kind of confidence do you have in Joe Ross, both from a performance standpoint but also from an opportunity standpoint?
I still feel pretty good there with how well he pitched last season, and he's a pretty notable prospect. I feel like he's going to be in the opening day rotation, as long as he shows well in spring training, and I think he has the talent to do that. I guess the addition of Arroyo, if Arroyo turns out and Roark goes to the bullpen, gives them a little more flexibility if they want to kind of manage Ross's innings, and I don't think we were thinking he was going to be a 200-inning pitcher anyways, but this gives them that flexibility, especially if they're going through the season we saw with the Mets last year, the trouble they ran into. If the Nats are going through the season and starting to think, okay, we're going to be in the postseason, it gives them that chance to skip Ross sometimes maybe in the second half or push him back a bit. None of that really matters to me on fantasy draft day in March. I can play those moves as they come along in the second half.
Right. So, I mean, to some extent, nearly every pitcher comes with some kind of innings risk. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I, that unfortunately kind of to some extent wraps up what we've got transaction-wise thus far. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about kids, which is good, which is fun, which is a little daunting because I'm not nearly the prospect expert I used to be, or not expert, but prospect geek. So I'm going to have to ask you about these guys. We start, and the reason we're doing this to some extent partly is that MLB.com, by the way, is rolling out all of its prospect list. Top 100 coming soon. Top 10 by position is out. Start with catcher. And one interesting name on that list, Gary Sanchez, is a guy who looks like he might have a little opportunity and now looks like he might not have any opportunity with the signing of Carlos Corporan to the Yankees. How do you like – I mean, it's tough to get really excited about a guy backing up Brian McCann anyway, but what do you think about Gary Sanchez coming into this year?
Yeah, long-term good prospect. This year I'm not expecting him to dent fantasy rosters. It would have to take, like, a long-term injury to McCann, and then the Yankees would also have to commit to him playing regularly after that time happens. But McCann's pretty durable, so I just don't really see it happening. Overall, when you look at the top 10 list that Pipeline's producing right now at the different positions, catcher looks the most bleak as far as 2016 fantasy help. And that can go into someone's draft day decisions a little bit where you think, like, oh, I'm not going to find that, you know, golden prospect partway through the season at that position, so I'm going to need to make sure I'm pretty well covered. As we'll talk about some of these other positions here in a few minutes, there are players that fantasy owners can think, okay, that guy's probably going to get the call, and when he gets the call, if I pounce, you know, he could make a difference. Maybe I can get by with someone in the meantime. At catcher, I think what you see in the majors is what you've got for this year. For the most part, I don't think we're going to see a big difference maker come up.
Do you think generally that may not be all that unusual? Just in as far much as catching prospects seem iffier than nearly anything but pitching prospects. It just seems kind of anecdotally. Is that your experience that for some reason it just feels like catcher prospects maybe have a little higher bust rate than other positions?
Yeah, for sure. And at the same time, the bar is so – if you're in a two-catcher fantasy league, the bar is so low for what makes a starting catcher in that format where you'll need, like, 24 or 30 catchers in your league. That if – like, you look at JT Realmuto last year with the Marlins, he comes up – he does fine, nothing, like, unbelievable, but he's quickly quite valuable in two-catcher leagues just because the players he's replacing, you know, Deonner Navarro and players like that don't have a very high bar themselves. So – a catcher could come up, and if he gets regular playing time, he's almost helpful in two catcher leagues immediately. I just don't see that guy, like, coming up really soon. But you're right, they're big risks just because of all the other demands of their position.
You just think about a guy like Christian Bethencourt, who a year or two ago was everybody's darling, and now the Braves can't get rid of fast enough. It's a tough job. We move around the diamond, and this is a position where we might see some guys get some playing time. I personally became an A.J. Reed fan 2 years ago. I saw him here in Athens with the University of Kentucky and saw him hit a ball that I'm not sure has landed yet. The Astros are making noises like Reed might get a real opportunity. How much do you like him?
Yeah, a lot. And I like him more and more every day that we go through free agency without the Astros picking up a first baseman. So right now it probably looks like John Singleton. And I believe Singleton has a 171 batting average so far in his pretty brief career. But Singleton's a guy, you know, who was a prospect and hasn't really panned out. It doesn't take much imagination to see a scenario where maybe Singleton opens the season at first base, doesn't perform well, and they quickly need to try someone like Reed, and then he just hits the ground running. Or if you want to get super optimistic, you know, Singleton looks terrible in spring training and Reed looks great, and they just go for it. The Astros showed last year, you know, Correa, Velasquez, McCullers, that if they have a good prospect, they'll bring him up, you know, when they think he can help the team in the middle of the season. So I feel like we see Reed in the first half or around the All-Star game at the latest, and then I think he helps fantasy teams because of that power.
What jumps out to me about Reed, I mean, the power to some extent is obvious. He's a guy who hits the ball a mile. The thing that jumps out to me, he hit .324 in the minors. He's averaged fewer than a strikeout every five plate appearances. Now, that doesn't seem like nothing, but that's pretty good for a guy with his kind of power. Do you think that stuff translates? Do you think he's the Astros have a lot have had a lot of these power only guys? Do you think maybe he kind of mixes that up as in a guy who maybe hits for average, puts some balls in play in addition to the power, even in the big leagues?
Yeah, I do, and that's what makes me really optimistic about him. The Astros kind of showed, I think, from walking away from Chris Carter, that that's not the kind of player they want. I mean, they could have chosen to bring him back, and they didn't. And, you know, and that also makes me think that they're not going to be really high on Singleton, who's going to give them the same kind of profile. So if they're looking for more of a well-rounded hitter, and they're pretty, the Astros are pretty loaded at the top of the lineup, right? Altuve, Springer, Correa. It's more them lengthening their lineup with tougher outs, so, and Reed could be that guy for them.
And the number two first base prospect is a guy probably a little less of an obvious opportunity. Do you see a chance for Josh Bell in 2016, or is he probably a little farther down the road?
Yeah, I guess it's possible, but he'll need some things to go his way. You know, they have John Jaso and Mike Morris now to kind of platoon at first base. So if he, even if one of those players was injured, like, would Bell come up and join that? He might, but he'd have to come up and get a regular role to be a mixed league fantasy factor. And I'm just not sure if that'll happen unless he gets, you know, a really good break and a couple players are injured and they really need that offense. Yeah, would you agree? Do you feel like if you were investing a pick that you'd much rather have Reed than Bell for this year?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Just because of that opportunity. But also, you know, you've got the ballpark, you've got tying in with opportunity is that DH spot, which opens the door a little more. I like Reed a lot. Again, you know, I'm a college baseball fan, have been all my life. I have a certain bias. You can't bring these biases into draft day, but I love guys that I saw in college. And again, he was a guy who was just a freak as a college player. We move. You know, second base is such an interesting prospect position because there's this sort of old wisdom about second base prospects or guys who kind of couldn't cut it somewhere else. And I think that kind of shows to some extent in our top second base prospects, because the number one guy is a guy who isn't going to play anywhere near the majors this year, I don't think, Yoan Moncada. Number two guy, Jose Peraza, is maybe a low ceiling but high floor guy. What do you see in Peraza? I'm not crazy about him, but there's speed. It seems like there's opportunity. Do you like Peraza coming into this year?
Yeah, he might be someone who profiles as a more valuable fantasy player than actual baseball player. I'm pretty optimistic. I feel like the Reds wanted him, like, all offseason. He was in those, and who knows exactly what happened, but he was in those Chapman rumors when they were talking to the Dodgers about Chapman. And then when they eventually did make the three-team trade, they got him. And I know some people speculated from the outside that they were surprised the Reds for Frazier just didn't take what the White Sox were throwing out in that three-team deal. It seemed like they really wanted Peraza. Now, he doesn't really have a spot to play right now, but there's some moving pieces there. If they can get him in the lineup, I feel like he can help fantasy owners right away because he can hit for average, he can steal bases, and Cincinnati has no one who naturally fits as a leadoff hitter. So, I mean, and they're rebuilding. So, he might not be someone you draft if the Reds lineup doesn't change and Brandon Phillips is still blocking him, but if he gets his chance, like you could maybe hope for a .280 batting average, stolen bases, and runs if he's hitting out of the leadoff spot. I can understand why you're not, like, really high on him from a baseball perspective, but it's just trying to figure out how he gets in the lineup. Do you agree that it seemed like they were kind of interested in him all offseason?
Yeah, for sure. And look, part of that was I think they thought they were going to trade Brandon Phillips. Brandon Phillips still being around definitely complicates things, but Peraza's not only a second baseman, and they also have a shortstop, and they also have a third baseman, but you know, one of the things I could see with Peraza is him getting playing time at all three of those positions.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they could just say, yeah, you're going to play, you know, like we're going to move guys around, and Suarez can play multiple positions, so they could get Peraza in the lineup maybe if they're playing six games a week, 4 or 5 days, just by moving him around. And if this is a rebuilding year for them, and it certainly is, like getting him a regular amount of playing time seems much more important than getting Zach Cozart a regular amount of playing time.
Absolutely. Now, whether that happens is another matter. But and you know, we've been focusing mostly on the top two guys on these lists, but second baseman is an interesting position in that some of the guys with potential impact this year are further down the list. So I want to kind of ask you about a couple of guys further down our top 10 second basemen. Micah Johnson and Rob Refsnyder are both guys who seem more or less ready. There's some question of opportunity. Is either one of those guys that you might take a flyer on thinking he might get a chance as the year goes on.
Yeah, Raf Snyder I was interested in, but he just seems to be blocked right now. Now, he's another guy, though, that could get up to the majors in a couple different ways. If Starlin Castro were to be injured, he could come up to be their second baseman. At the same time, if Gregorius were to be injured, Castro could slide over to short, and he could come up and be their second baseman. They do have Dustin Ackley there, who they could use like in a pinch for a short amount of time. But Raf Snyder interests me more, even though I know Micah Johnson's super fast and can steal bases. I'm not sure exactly what the Dodgers' plans are. I guess it's how much are they going to play Enrique Hernandez at second base, and how much are they going to use him in the outfield, like with Utley. And does Johnson have a chance to make the opening day roster, really, or not?
I mean, to me, the question is, it seems to be less about Johnson opening day and more about how much are you really betting on Chase Utley staying healthy, and would they just plug Hernandez in at second base, or would they, in that event, because again, I don't think it's going out on a limb to say it's a pretty good chance that Chase Utley hits the DL this year. If that happens, does Hernandez stay in a bouncing all around, and maybe they just call up Johnson and slot him in as their second baseman? That's kind of the path I see for him, rather than getting fit in somewhere from the start. It's that if there's an injury, I could see him becoming the second baseman for them.
Yeah, for sure. Now, were you surprised last year that he didn't win that, like, and hold that second base job in Chicago? I was a little surprised that he made such a small impact last year.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, that team was disappointing in a lot of ways. That was an odd team. So, you know, it's silly to say, you know, something in the water, but at the same time, you do kind of wonder when it just all doesn't work for a club, if that maybe weighs heavier, is more of a challenge for a younger guy. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
We will continue bouncing around, and we have one more position to hit while we are talking the top 10 per position, and that is third base. And there's one guy that is an awful lot of fun on that list, and that's Joey Gallo. They got to find some way for him to play this year, don't they?
You would think so. I mean, if they don't find it by opening day, like, they're already talking about Josh Hamilton and whether he can stay healthy this season. To me, that's the clearest path for him to be a regular in the lineup. You know, they just come to the realization that Hamilton can't go and has to be on the disabled list for a while, and then they make Gallo, you know, an everyday outfielder. But there's a lot of ways they could get him into the lineup if, like, eventually, just playing the odds, someone will be injured, and there's a lot of players there. You know, Mitch Moreland can play multiple spots, and, you know, Beltre could get injured, or Prince Fielder. There's just a lot of ways they could get him in the lineup. So I'm not panicking if he's not in the opening day lineup or even on the roster. I feel like the odds are pretty good that he can get, you know, 350, 400 at-bats this season, if not more.
How much do you like Gallo if he does get that playing time?
I'm a little worried about the batting average, for sure. I think you have to be. But I take my chance because he has so much power. You know, like, what would you think if let's say he gets 400 at-bats this season, does he hit 250?
I mean, to me, that's the question. And it's so hard. You know, it seems to me that, especially for guys that young and that extreme, that in this era, two guys we think of as sort of 240, 250 hitters can become 190, 200 hitters, and then you're worried. It's not that I think he's that guy, but we're just in such an extreme low-contact, high-strikeout context right now that it's just kind of double-edged sword to me, in that on the one hand, sure, you worry less, and if a guy hits 240, that doesn't really hurt you the way maybe it used to. On the other hand, I feel like it's really easy to see extreme guys like that sliding way down to a point where they do hurt you.
For sure, and it's about playing time, and a 280 hitter when he's in a slump hits 240 and doesn't lose his spot usually in the lineup, and a 240 hitter when he's in a slump and hits 190 or 200, now is when you start to hear the calls for, you know, for that guy to get out of the lineup, and you want a team's manager to ride a player through a slump and let him hit his way out of it and stay in the lineup. You know, I mean, I don't think that Joey Gallo is Chris Bryant by any means, but you know, we saw Chris Bryant last season swing and miss at a lot of pitches and strike out very often and still have a monster fantasy season. And as I said, I don't think he is Chris Bryant, but there are lots of examples out there, as you said, right now, with players who are missing a lot of pitches, but when they're connecting, they're still doing enough damage to be really helpful in fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that worries me in those cases is sometimes you start getting calls for the player to change. I mean, I think about a guy like Jock Peterson, who for a lot of the time when people were blaming him was still being effective. But yeah, you get that average down low and it starts looking bad. You know, elsewhere at third base, we've been mostly focusing on top two prospects, but I don't think anybody really thinks Rafael Devers is a guy who is that guy this year. Further down the list, another interesting name to me is Richie Schaefer. That's a guy who got a little time last year. There might be an opportunity, though. Steve Pierce might cut into his time. What do you think about Schaefer for both performance and opportunity in 16?
Yeah, I was interested in him maybe for AL only, at least at the start of the season, until they signed Pierce. And now I'm not sure if he's going to make the team or not. Like, it'll kind of depend how healthy they are coming out of spring training. But Longoria's at third base been pretty durable the last couple of years. And I know he wasn't earlier in his career, but he seems to have gotten past that. And Pierce, I feel like, kind of fills the role that maybe we were looking at for him. Like, now they've got Pierce and they've got James Loney and they've got Logan Morrison to rotate between first base and DH, and Pierce can help in the outfield a bit. He might need, a couple injuries to get some playing time, and he's certainly a nice prospect if he gets into a regular role at some point. Like, he's someone I would pick up, but he's not someone I would draft now.
How much do you like Pierce at all coming off a rough year? Is he an interesting sort of upside play to you?
Not really. To me, he can get you double-digit homers in an AL-only league. For him to get into a mixed league, he's going to need to have more than 400 at-bats, and I just don't see that really happening, partially maybe due to his own production, and then partially just due to the way their roster is constructed right now.
Yeah. It's a weird team where there are a whole bunch of guys that you wouldn't be shocked if they busted out and gave you 450, 500 really good productive at-bats, but you wouldn't want to bet on any one of them doing it. Which is
they've cornered the market on some, like, kind of post-type fantasy darlings, with Pierce, with Logan Morrison, with Brad Miller. Steven Souza's a guy, he's a little post-type already, where he tantalizes because he could have a 2020 year. Like, Desmond Jennings, right? Like, is another guy who didn't stay healthy, but, he goes through stretches where he looks like he's going to really break out, but then he kind of just settles back into being who he is. So there's a lot of really high variability players there.
You watch and hope, but you don't really hit your wagon any of them. Our last segment today, and goodness, it's gone by quickly, we are going to talk catcher. And as you already noted, catcher is, it's always a tough position, but it seems like it's a particularly tough position now. You have two guys standing alone at the top among catchers. Who are those guys, and why do they – one of them is obvious why he stands up. Why do they stand out even from the next tier?
I was going to put Buster Posey in the top tier all by himself. I decided to put Kyle Schwarber with him. I would, without hesitation, take Posey, before Schwarber in any draft. But Schwarber could give him, depending on how the season goes, a bit of a run for his money. Posey is so good. And, the way you're going to approach the catcher position in fantasy really depends so much on whether it's a one-catcher or a two-catcher league. And we don't see that really as much with other positions. But if it's a one-catcher league, I feel like you're either, Posey or Schwarber in an early round 3, 4, 5. And if you don't get that, then it's almost like tight ends in fantasy football. You just wait and take one late because you only need about 12 in your league. If it's a two-catcher league and you're looking at 24 or in a 15-team league, 30 catchers, now all of a sudden catcher production becomes really valuable because when you get to the bottom of the list, you see some really weak catchers. So the difference Posey can give you in a two-catcher league, he's worth at least a second-round pick. He's so good. He's so consistent. He's one of the few catchers who can, threaten to hit 300, and he does it on a regular basis. 20 homers, hits in the cleanup spot. He's just remarkable. I think he dominates his position more than any other player in fantasy dominates theirs. That being said, Schwarber's got that potential from what we saw last season where he could hit 30 home runs this year. And if he could hit 30 home runs, that almost never happens at the catcher position. It almost never happens where you have a catcher and he's among the league leaders in home runs. So, I would take Posey over Schwarber by a good round at least, but Schwarber has that massive potential. He's one of the most variable players, heading into 2016 draft.
Yeah, that's the thing I wanted to follow up on about him with you. Schwarber, now, again, didn't spend a lot of time in the minors, but during his brief time in the minors, hit 333 and showed a really nice strike zone. He had 246 in the majors and showed a much less nice strike zone, though he drew a decent number of walks. Which of those do you think is closer to reality this year? Do you think he gets back some of that, or do you think maybe he's a little bit more of an all-or-nothing guy in the majors than he was in the minors.
Yeah, I'm going to hope that and be kind of optimistic that he could get back some of that because, you know, if you just think about him coming up, you know, like he's coming up, you know, he's in the middle of a race in the summer when he comes up. And I feel like, yeah, maybe you just lose some of that discipline that you showed in the minors. You know, you just want to hit. You hit a couple homers. You know, people are praising you for that. You know that's a little bit why you're there. So maybe you let some of those skills slide a little bit in an attempt to just, you know, have those game-changing moments and get yourself a chance to stay in the lineup. Whereas now this year he's more secure. He'll go through spring training with the club and then be with them on opening day. So maybe this lets him relax and kind of work on some of those other skills other than just hitting for power, like controlling the strike zone.
Your next tier is a mix of some guys maybe kind of on the downside. Lucroy is a guy who not that long ago would have been contending for that top tier. Do you think he is declining, and do you maybe bump him up the slightest bit out of hope that maybe if he gets traded somewhere, he gets reinvigorated and has a different look to him?
I guess it's possible, although if he gets traded, there's also the downside that he leaves Miller Park and goes to a team, you know, with a more spacious home park, because he's not a great power hitter in the first place. So, and I feel like that's where he kind of teeters the line. You're right, he was someone who was kind of almost approaching maybe second tier by himself at one point, but it just never really happened. Like, we just didn't see him. We've seen him have a high batting average season. We've seen some power, but he's not someone who's been able to lock in that 20-plus homer power. So I feel like now we just maybe it's time to give up on that and just say, okay, he is what he is. If he stays healthy, he's a 15-20 homer guy with a solid batting average. And that's kind of tier two.
Well, and that's my question. And you know, we're talking about Schwarber as a guy who maybe hits 250 and is near the top of the list. Posey is alone. I mean, that's a separate thing. But the thing I could see from Lucroy is him getting back to a 280, 290, even 300 kind of hitter. And if he does that, that changes it a lot, doesn't it? I mean, if he's 290 with even 10 or 12 home runs, that's pretty valuable, a catcher, don't you think?
Yeah, for sure. That's what he'd have to do is get back in that 290 to 300 range. But coming off the injury, you know, plagued year, and his batting average has really fluctuated. If you're going to play it safe, you're probably going to more project him to hit 275 or something like that, which that gets him into the second tier. But 275 with like about 15, 17 homers isn't going to get you into that top tier because other owners, and it's going to barely keep you, it's going to keep you in the second tier, but not by a lot, because another owner is going to be able to find someone who maybe only hits 240 or 250, but hits over 20 home runs. For me, also with Lucroy, it'll be lineup position because he needs those counting stats. Like, you know, I want to see him to stay in tier two. I want to see him, you know, 75 or so, 70 to 75 at least with his runs and his RBIs, because he's never been a really big RBI producer.
The guy you have in there, the two other guys you have in there, you kind of think of together to some extent. They're oddly similar players at this point of their careers, actually. Russell Martin and Brian McCann are both last year were kind of low-average sluggers. They were not that similar earlier in their career. What separates those two guys? Do you like one over the other? How do you, if somebody's looking at those two guys, how do you look at them?
Yeah, I think there's very little to separate them. And if I was drafting and, you know, I was ready to take a catcher and they were both there, I think I would take McCann just barely. I feel like his power is a little more stable. And he did drive in a ton of runs last season. Like, he led all catchers in RBIs, including Posey, last year. So, I mean, you know, but you're right. They're pretty much the same guy. They're probably not going to hit 250, but they'll provide you with a lot of power. And they're both in strong lineups, so the overall runs in RBIs should be there. Maybe McCann slanted a little more towards RBIs, and Martin a little more balanced between those two categories. But yeah, to me, they're really in two catcher leagues really valuable. In one catcher leagues, like, they're nice guys to have, maybe a little more for the security than some of the names we'll see in the third tier, but I just don't see, and I don't know if you disagree with me, but I don't see any sort of bump coming where they threaten the guys above them.
No, I mean, I think at this point McCann is what he is, and he's hit within about 3 points of the same average three of the last 4 years. Martin's is a guy, Martin's been so all over the place that it wouldn't shock me if he had one more of those huge years, and it wouldn't shock me if he hit 210 again. He's a hard guy to figure, but I think if you're projecting them, you project them similarly. You look at Tier 3, and I want to start with one guy that I'm just a shameless honk for. I'm an enormous Travis d'Arnaud fan. I think he got way too little credit for the Mets' second-half surge last year. He was a guy who really arrived back from injury about the same time Cespedes arrived and was very nearly as big a part of their offense. What is it that keeps him down a step relative to the guys on Tier 2? I guess what I'm saying is it seems maybe you don't like d'Arnaud quite as much as I do. Why is that?
I guess it's just the concerns about him being able to stay healthy, you know, and log that 450 at-bat season that you feel pretty certain that you'll get from Martin and McCann. So, to me, that's the only thing. The third tier is interesting because there's a lot of directions. There's more players in it, and there's more variety. And you can almost pick which way you want to go. If you want to look at someone who could very quickly get in Tier 2, then d'Arnaud is one of the best options in that third tier. He just needs to prove that he can stay healthy. With him having had, multiple injuries, and, we've talked about what's the difference between injury-prone or just unlucky, and we'll find out, I guess, with him in the next year or two. But that's all he's got to do. He's got Tier 2 skills. He just hasn't had Tier 2 durability so far.
This, as you note, a wide range of options in that group. A guy like Sal Perez is pretty predictable, assuming he stays healthy, but he's a guy I almost wonder, like, when is he going to get hurt, even though he never has? Realmuto is a guy who emerged last year. I still kind of wonder how high his ceiling is. A guy I wanted to ask you about, though, is Wieters, who is somebody I'm optimistic about. I see him as, I don't know if he's a sleeper because he's a big name, but I if people are scared off of him, that's a guy I would love to pick a little late and think I might have gotten something big. Do you see him that way, as somebody who, if you can steal him late, you might be in for something good?
Yeah, for sure. And before I give away my thoughts on Wieters, I'll ask you this. If you were drafting and you had d'Arnaud and Wieters available, which one would you select?
I for me, I go d'Arnaud in a heartbeat just because he was so good when he plays, and I still worry. The worry to me is not how much Wieters plays, it's how much he gets back to where he was. The worry to me with d'Arnaud is strictly, does he play? Because personally, again, I'm a huge fan. I think if he plays, he's good.
Yeah, for sure. I've been optimistic on Wieters partially because when he has played the past two seasons, and he hasn't played much, but when he has played, his bat has been fine. I'm not too concerned about that. What made me, to be honest, more optimistic about Wieters was him taking that one-year contract from the Orioles. I mean, we talked a couple weeks ago about Span and Denard Span and the Giants, and you brought up a really good point that maybe Span was just running to the bank when he saw that a team was ready to give him a three-year contract. You know, Wieters could have gone on the open market and gotten a three-year contract or more. And he chose to believe in himself and take that one-year contract and then build up his value. Now, if you're Matt Wieters and you're sitting at home and you're thinking, hey, physically, like, I don't really have it anymore, like, I'm not fully recovered, I don't think you take the one-year contract. I think you tell your agent to just get you the best multi-year deal you can get. Because he took the one-year contract, I'm kind of now on Wieters' side where I'm saying, all right, if you believe in yourself, you know, I believe in you. The last two seasons, he's hit 13 homers in about 350 at-bats. So not that far off what he was before as a power hitter. To me, it's almost like d'Arnaud. My concern with d'Arnaud is can he, you know, stay off the disabled list for the whole year? Wieters, to me, is almost more all or nothing because that's kind of the way his career's gone. Like, I feel like from Wieters, we're either going to get 500 or 200 at-bats. With d'Arnaud, the reason I left him in Tier 3 is I'm concerned about getting 350 at-bats. And that has to matter a lot about whether you're in a one- or two-catcher league. If you're in a one-catcher league, I feel more safe with a guy like d'Arnaud or Wieters because there's going to be a lot of catchers on waivers if they hit the disabled list. If you're in a two-catcher league, like, holy moly, if they go on the disabled list, you're almost just picking up the guy who replaces them on their own roster because that's about all that you'll find there.
We're running near the end of our time. I have two last things for you. One is, out of the rest of these guys you have in three that we haven't mentioned, Derek Norris, Salvador Perez, Realmuto, Yan Gomes, Stephen Vogt, is there one of those guys that you particularly have your eye on to maybe jump out of that group?
I'd say, going back to my last point, I'd say two-catcher leagues, I'm probably going to stay safe and take Derek Norris. Like, everything's set up for him to just have a high volume of playing time. I don't think it's going to be a great lineup. I don't think the results will always be pretty, but I think the counting stats will be there at the end. Out of the players you mentioned, you know, I'm pretty interested in Gomes. you know, same kind of thing. Like he's really good in 2014, so he has that upside. Those are kind of in that tier three. If you want to go with the upside picks, Darnold, Weeters, Gomes, those are the guys I think you target. You hope he gets back to what he was in 2014, you know, but he did really struggle for a lot of last season. I purposely included Real Muto in there because I find fantasy owners, they just don't respect him because he doesn't hit for power. At the same time, at the end of the day, does it really matter if you get 20 homers from your catcher or if you get 12 homers and 8 steals? Because for most of the 20-homer catchers, you're getting 0 steals. And he can make up for that value because he probably will get 8, 9, 10 steals. He's an unusual case. You know, if you're later in your draft, you're really late on speed, every steal counts. You know, he might be the guy you go for. It's almost like you can tailor it at the end of your draft in a one-catcher league as to what you're still searching for.
And then one last thing, is there anybody beyond that group that you've got an eye on, that you're intrigued by, maybe a bounce back from Yadier Molina, maybe one last good year from Pierzynski? Is there anybody not on that list that you are intrigued by as maybe a second catcher or backup catcher?
Yeah, for sure. It's Mesoraco. You know, he showed it in 2014. So it's, you know, same as some of these other guys we were talking about, like Weeters. You know, he just has to prove that he's fully healthy. I read an article yesterday on MLB.com that he feels like he'll be 100% for spring training. So that's encouraging. But there's nothing quite like, you know, the rigors of actually doing that catching job every day. And then we'll see how he is physically. But, you know, he was a top 10 catcher a couple of years ago. So he could quickly get back on that list. And to be honest, if I was in a draft, you know, on our projections that'll come out in a couple of weeks, we have Vogt a little bit ahead of him, partly because we think Vogt will play more. So I kind of went with the mathematical solution. If I was drafting, I would probably just go for it and take someone like Mesoraco ahead of Vogt, who really struggled in the second half.
I think that makes sense because you probably don't want to count on either of those guys as your number one guy anyway, so take the upside.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's the Fantasy 411 podcast for this week. Fred Zinke, thanks very much. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And what do you say we do it again next week?
Yeah, for sure. We'll talk first baseman next week. Sounds good.